Good afternoon. The Subcommittee on Elections will come to order. We will note that it's 10 after 2 and there's still not a quorum present. But because there is no planned, thank you, Senator Hayden, for stepping into the room. So now a quorum is present. So members, if more members show up, we will introduce the new members of the committee and the new staff that we have leading the committee. But at this time, keeping in mind that now, because of the renovations happening at the state capitol, our committee times are compressed. We have the hearing room until 3:30. So we'll get started with testimony from the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. Mr. Goldsmith, Mr. Beck, and Mr. Sandy, thank you for, and Mr. Sigurdsson, thank you all for being here. Mr. Beck, it's my understanding that you would like to begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have a goal to give you an overview of what we do in the time allotted and provide you with an idea of what our activities have been in the past year and in the coming year. And our goal is to do that without putting anybody to sleep. We think we have an excellent chance of doing that today. I'm going to ask first Gary Goldsmith, our executive director, to touch on our overall responsibilities, our budget, and our website improvement project, and on the upcoming board member confirmations. Deputy Director Jeff Sigurdsson will then report on a few highlights of our technical bill this session, explain the data reconciliation project, and our online training video project for treasurers. Vice Chair Christian Sandy will comment on the implementation of the legislation you passed last session with changes in our complaint procedure. And finally, I will discuss some of the issues that the board is facing and expects to discuss this year. Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Thank you for hearing us this afternoon. I will be somewhat brief in describing what we do because I recognize at least most of the faces in this room. As you know, the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board has jurisdiction primarily over Chapter 10A of the Minnesota Statutes, which is called the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Act. We also have jurisdiction over three provisions of Section 211B, which is the Fair Campaign Practices Act. The legislature gave us that jurisdiction a couple of years ago, and specifically those provisions are ones where what we already do overlaps with what's in 211B, and so that is the use of money collected for campaign purposes, the prohibition on contributions by corporations, and the requirement to put a prepared and paid-for form of disclaimer on campaign materials. We have actually had a pretty successful effort in implementing our jurisdiction over those new provisions. We have had a few complaints regarding those provisions, and by the way, our assumption of that jurisdiction with respect to state-level candidates, it doesn't apply to local candidates, we hope has relieved the Office of Administrative Hearings, at least in some small part, because they previously had jurisdiction over those matters as it related to candidates who were already covered by Chapter 10A. We issue advisory opinions. We conduct investigations, both on the board's own motion and as a result of complaints filed with the board. We produce guidance, we produce handbooks, and we publish lots of data, making it available to the public, and that's one area where we recognize that we're not currently totally successful and not where we want to be, and I'll have more to say about that. I do want to mention that you will have at least one, and depending on how we schedule it, maybe more than one confirmation hearing for board members this year. The board is the only state agency or board where both bodies confirm its members, and they do that by a supermajority. Mr. Sandy was actually before this committee last year, but he was serving out the unexpired term of another member, and so he has applied for appointment to the full term, and we anticipate and hope that his appointment will be made by the governor. So we anticipate that he'll be up for confirmation. Member Dan Rosen, a Republican who is an attorney in Minneapolis, was appointed by the governor in the interim, so he'll be up. Representative Deanna Weiner, a former Democratic legislator, has announced that she was not seeking reappointment to her slot, so there'll be a DFL legislator to be appointed. And at the last meeting, Neil Peterson, a former Republican legislator, tendered his resignation to the governor so that he could attend to his business obligations. And so there'll also be a Republican former legislator up for approval. So four members out of six, which leaves Mr. Beck as our senior member. It's a young board in terms of experience, younger than we've tended to have in the past, but we have a hardworking, diligent group of people serving in a nonpartisan way on this board. This is not a budget hearing, and of course this body doesn't have direct jurisdiction over our budget, but I do want to comment on the budget, what happened 2 years ago, what we anticipate and hope will happen this year, and what we've done with the money, at least at a high level. As I think most of you know, the board 2 years ago requested a substantial increase in its budget from $689,000 to $1 million per fiscal year. The governor initially recommended that increase in his budget, but with the imposition of filing fees for candidates, parties, lobbyists, and others who had to do business with the Campaign Finance Board. And upon the board's recommendation, the governor in his revised budget still provided for the full amount of funding that was requested, but without registration fees, and that's the way the appropriation was passed. That $1 million in funding allowed us to do two things. It seems like a lot of money, but actually it isn't a lot when you talk about an agency whose budget is mostly taken up through staff, and in a state where state employee salaries tend to go up on a fairly regular basis. So that funding allowed us to do three things. One, to retain our existing staff at the same staffing level and to accommodate the increases that the negotiating committees and legislature had approved over the previous period. Secondly, we needed another staff member who was hired, and that is a legal analyst slash management analyst. We have 1.6 people in those positions now, and they handle a lot of the analysis work for complaints, but they also handle a lot of management analysis, process evaluation, process of improvement in the office, and so we added that one full-time position. Actually, right now, we're down by about a 0.6. We have one slot for an office support person, but for 0.6, we found that hard to fill because of the either lack of benefits or the need for the employee to pay 50% of the benefits because the state would not pick up the full cost of benefits. So we will be making another effort to fill that position, but right now that's vacant. Now, there was some additional money in that $1 million besides the staffing and the additional position. That amounted to about $150,000 per year, and I indicated 2 years ago that $150,000 would be a shrinking target or a shrinking cushion because, as I anticipated, every 2 years when the state contracts are renegotiated, there tends to be an increase, and I was not wrong in anticipating that increase. So in the coming year, in the coming biennium, we expect to have about $75,000 per fiscal year to devote to ongoing efforts to improve and further develop our website and our public outreach, the tools that we can use both to help citizens and to help those who are in the regulated communities. We've made a big start on that, although it's not visible if you look at our website. Unfortunately, the part that you see is really usually the last part that gets done because everything that's behind that has to come first. And so, first of all, we had to deal with infrastructure, and that includes both hardware, software, and network infrastructure, and that is nearly completed. We have one small project, I should say one medium-sized project, starting at the end of this month, which is to do the fine-tuning on our virtual network system, and then the infrastructure component will be complete. Right now and for the future, our website is hosted dually. It's hosted in part by Minute Services and in part on our own server system, including our virtual network. That's going to have to be the case for the indefinite future because Minute Services does not host databases that require access to a database. And so most state agencies actually have some component of their database hosted in their agency home site rather than in the Minute on the Minute site itself. And ours is that way now. It's sort of transparent. If you look at the website, you might not realize that you're actually bouncing between a couple of servers, but that's the way it is. And it will continue because we need to host that data, because a large part of what people want to see in a campaign finance website is the data. And that's one of the areas where we're kind of woefully inadequate right now, and that's one of the areas that's getting the most attention. When we talk about data, and we are, in fact, a disclosure agency, and that means providing data not just to you and your opponents and the parties, but to the public in a meaningful way. We know we don't successfully do that in the way we'd like to in the future. We don't currently do that. As we looked at the situation, the first thing we recognized was that for data to be valuable to you or to the public, the quality of the data has to be top-notch. And the Star Tribune did an article a couple of years ago. Mr. Sigurdsson will give you a complete update on that. But they pointed out some problems in our data where one entity was reporting one thing and the entity on the other side was reporting something different. And we've been working on fixing that. Mr. Sigurdsson will talk to you about that. That's one of the quality of data issues that's involved. Another quality of data issue that you're all probably familiar with is what I call name standardization. When reports are filed, donors' names come in various ways, and we take the data the way it comes in from the filer. So a donor who tends to donate to lots of candidates or lots of party units may be in our system 4, 5, or 6 times. And in the current system, you have to search that donor name 4, 5, or 6 times to add up all the contributions from that donor. Our staff has made it a little easier, but it isn't where it needs to be. And the solution to that problem is name standardization, where names that are submitted by filers are mapped into a standard name that we've verified is, in fact, the same person. And then when you do your search on the Internet, you will see all of that donor's contributions or whatever the transactions might be under one name.
So, Mr. Goldsmith, excuse me, if I could just ask then, so is the new database, if you want to search for a particular donor or a lobbyist or a PAC name to see all of the contributions that individual or PAC made, can you do that now?
You can't do it easily now. You would have to search under multiple donor names.
And what's the timeline for changing that?
Sure. We started a project the first Monday in January. We brought on a database developer.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago?
Seems longer ago, but yes, just January, the first Monday in January. We have a 16-week project that will accomplish several things, all related to the data. One is the name standardization project, but even before that is the fact that our databases themselves are very legacy. They were developed before we were using data in any way on the Internet, in fact, before there really was an Internet. And so the tables, we have a separate table for donors to candidates and a separate table for donors to party units and PACs. We have separate tables throughout the system, and one of the components of this project that we're engaged in now is to make sure those tables are merged and properly structured so that we can access that data easily for the Internet. That project is likely going to take the full 16 weeks that we have allocated for it. The second project that I expect to put out probably next week is going to be for an actual web developer. The database developer, working with staff, gets the data into the format and tables where it can be accessed. The web developer then writes the code to actually access that data and put it on the website. I would expect, and I hope, and I'm not going to go so far as to say a promise, but it's a very high goal of mine to have a significant improvement in the way you're able to access, for example, donor data before the end of this fiscal year.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. That's it's important that you talk about this because that right now the website, it is. You have to get a calculator out, and you got to get a piece of paper, and you got to get hitting, and God forbid you miss one and you do your report, you know, then you got to go back and you got some splaining to do, Lucy. And so I'm glad you're talking about this because at $75,000 per year, it was always a question of whether or not we're going to actually judicially get this thing done for the next election cycle because, as you know, Madam Chair, 2016 is going to be an expensive cycle. And, you know, it would be important because we're also up against the LARS, the MnLARS project that's also Minute is being prodded in that. And maybe Mr. Goldsmith can kind of talk about that. That's $93 million. That's actually going to place a Minute behind. And so I have a conceptual concern that there's a capacity problem with the ability to do that. And I guess the question first to start off with, Mr. Goldsmith, Madam Chair, if you just let me know, is do you think that you're able to get ready with the current funding that you have right now in order to get ready for the 2016 election cycle?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, I do think that. I think that if we proceed on the schedule that I'm anticipating, I think we will do that. I think that I've looked at a lot of IT projects. I'm familiar with MnLARS. Some members may remember Health Match, Minnesota Health Match. That's a project it started actually back in 2003. It was abandoned in 2011 after $41 million and nothing to show for it. The problem with IT projects, and it doesn't matter if they're MnSure or MnLARS or Health Match or the Campaign Finance Board's project, they have to be planned and managed. And that's why they tend to take longer than people anticipate. Because before you see something on the internet, all of the other work has to be done. The last thing you see is when it is actually published on the internet. And everything else has to be done ahead of time. Right now we have enough money for this biennium to fund all of the staffing that we need. Let me say that we're not dependent on Minute Services to do this. That's why I have brought on our own DB developer, and I'm going to bring on our own web developer. As I mentioned, the database components are going to have to be served on our website anyway. Minute Services, initially I thought they would be able to do development, but they really don't do custom development outside of sort of the standard state web page that many agencies have, and they're right now in a transition to a new hosting system, so they're not actually taking new hosting. But most of what needs to be done can be done outside of Minute. Now, let me say, though, that we're not doing this without Minute's participation. For one thing, Minute has put into place a program called ASAPIT Services. It's a staff augmentation program that they have gone to all the work of finding the vendors, qualifying the vendors. They work closely with the Department of Administration and Purchasing. And it's through that program that we are able to very easily, with a minimum of internal overhead, put on a staff augmentation person for 8, 16 weeks, however many weeks we might need it. And so we're using that program. We do use Minute for lots of other things, telephones and web and so on. But
Mr. Goldsmith, Senator Hoffman first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. That's it's good to hear that you see the complexities of the Minute and the MnLARS, you know, thing that could be holding up here. I guess the question from my perspective is how can we help support you so that, you know, by this fall that you're on, it sounds like you have a plan in place and because I think if by this fall we don't see significant improvement in the website, there's probably, I don't know, 8-10 people around this table that will be asking the same question. But, you know, maybe if the board or you, Madam Chair, maybe it's a question to you as the chair is, you know, I would like to see some kind of updates just so that we can help them if they need some kind of response from us financially or resource-wise or what's
and
the...
And, Senator Hoffman, this gets to one of my main questions, which is, if I'm not mistaken, in the last biennium, there was an additional $130,000 appropriation to the Campaign Finance Board for an update of the database. Is that correct, Mr. Goldsmith?
Madam Chair, members, actually, that's not technically correct. In my presentation, I explained that we would have about 150,000 actually for infrastructure type projects and improvements. But I had a list of it projects. The website was certainly one of them. The network was one. Converting to electronic records, which was one, which we haven't even begun to approach. A client communication tracking service so that when we talk to one person, everybody will know that and we don't give conflicting advice to various clients. That hasn't been implemented. So we are using that money, in fact, for the website and the underlying structure that's needed to import the website to
okay.
support the website.
So,
yes.
Mr. Goldsmith, then with those revised numbers, I'm not a technical person, but from your explanation, I understand that you were working on the overall network this past year, and so that many of those issues are resolved. What I think about when I think back to the joint hearing we had with the House Elections Committee last year were the things that came to the attention as a result of the Star Tribune report was the searchability of the website, the ability to have the website be internet-based. I remember discussion mm-hmm. about that. And then obviously the reconciliation, which we've already touched on. But on those three things, the internet-based, the searchability, and the reconciliation, could you give me a more concrete timeline of when those things are going to be accomplished?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. I will be candid, as I always try to be with not only committees but individuals, and tell you that I did not meet the timeline I had hoped to meet with making progress during fiscal year 2014. We didn't make a lot of progress on the actual data aspect as far as getting it web ready. Mr. Sigurdsson will talk to you more about reconciliation, but I think we are about at the point where we will be recommending to the board that we not do anything with reconciliation going back further than we have. We're in the 90 or high 90 percentiles reconciled.
But and when I'm thinking about I understand that you've done work from the past, but what about ensuring that the new website or the new design fixes some of that so it doesn't keep happening?
Madam Chair, the website can't really fix that because it results from user error in filing reports. So a donor will report to us that they gave money to a particular entity that maybe has a similar name to some other entity, and the correct recipient will report the receipt and they don't match. Almost every reconciliation matter results from either a donor or a recipient making a mistake on a report. And so the only way that we can resolve those is, well, there are two things. One is manually, which is what we do now when we run reports to find the mismatches. The other is dealt with at least partly in the board's, what we're calling our technical bill, and that is to require filers to include registration numbers when they report either donations or receipts from entities. But even that isn't going to be foolproof. There's always going to be a manual
but
reconciliation.
But now you do require that, or you're going to start requiring that?
We are asking, Madam Chair, we're asking the legislature to amend the statute to permit us to require that. People who file with the board software do provide that already.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Goldsmith. In regards to that question, when we do our data entry, and I think most everybody uses the campaign finance software, when you select something that has a registration number, that registration number is automatically populated into that field. So I don't see how requiring us to enter that number is going to can you explain maybe how that actually would improve things from what it is now,
Mr. Goldsmith?
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, it won't improve things for users of the campaign finance software because that number is then sent to us with your report. It will allow us to require it for commercial vendors who don't use our software. Our our filing, electronic filing, is implemented by all the major commercial vendors and is used by some of the parties and typically constitutional office candidates. And as I mentioned, though, that isn't always the problem. The problem sometimes is just that the donor, even with a number, doesn't identify the proper recipient, or the recipient, even with a number, doesn't identify the proper donor.
Mr. Sigurdson, welcome to the committee.
Please state your name. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jeff Sigurdson, Assistant Director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. To Senator Kiffmeyer's question, although we have no authority to require the use of the registration number when they report through CFR, you may recall on the data entry screen that most people go to a rather lengthy drop-down list of political committees or funds or party units. The problem with that, frankly, is that there are hundreds of those things, and many of them start with the word Minnesota. So even with best intentions, many volunteer treasurers simply select the wrong one. On that same screen, you have the option of typing in the registration number directly, and we have found that in most, not all cases, but in most cases, the check actually has the committee registration number on there. We have, just as a help sheet to try to reduce the reconciliation issue, been sending out with reports or the report notification to treasurers the request, again, not a requirement, that they use the data entry field for the registration number. And I think that we have been very satisfied with the apparent reduction that we're going to have with the number of records that we need to reconcile. Although we don't have the final numbers for 2014, obviously the Senate, for example, hasn't reported at all. But nonetheless, currently, even before starting the reconciliation project, we're at over 90% reconciled for 2014. And I think that a certain amount of that is because, again, treasurers are ending in registration numbers instead of the actual pull-down list.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sigurdson. That's very helpful. One of my questions, though, would be in regards to that, what if it isn't on the check, and what if a contribution comes in and there is no registration number with that check or in that sort of way? I know the campaign finance software is quite good at helping us out and saying this might be a potential, but there are occasions, it might be somebody newer maybe. Are there situations like that, and could you explain how this might help that situation, your proposal here?
Mr. Sigurdson.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I agree. That certainly does occur, which is why the technical bill has the provision that will now require people to include that on the check, simply to try to reduce the number of times that a treasurer, a volunteer treasurer, finds a check that doesn't have that number. This will, again, kind of push them towards the point of providing that number either on a letter or on the check when they make the contribution. It's trying to provide more information to the volunteer treasurer so they can spend less time worrying about the registration and more time getting the information into the software.
Mr. Sigurdson, is the database going to be searchable? So, for example, if you receive a check that does not have a registration number, but you know that the committee is titled Minnesotans for Clean Elections, can you search Clean Elections anywhere and then find a list of all the potential matches it could be?
Madam Chair,
right now?
Yes, ma'am. The software does do that right now. You basically start typing in the name, and it drops down and tries to match as you go along. So, you know, you type in Minnesotans, it's going to drop down to the M's, and then you select from there.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That is correct, and that's very helpful. But one of the things I found about that is you have to have the exact letter that it starts with. And so, like in some searchable situations, if you start typing clean, any part of the title that has the word clean in it will show up. But if it's, say, Clean Elections for Minnesota instead of Minnesotans for Clean Elections, and you try searching on M, you won't find it. And so the searching issue there of any of those, so have you taken a look at that as part of this at all, of refining? Now, that's more of a campaign finance software thing, but enabling that to search on any part of that particular naming column.
Mr. Sigurdson.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm going to start my answer, although I'm going to turn it back to Mr. Goldsmith, because this is what he was referring to the name standardization, making sure that names are being used the same in our database. But also, the issue of, frankly, making sure that when a committee comes in and they register, and for example, it's Minnesotans for something, that we always display all of those the same way, that we don't display some with an MN for something and some with an MINN for something, or some spelled out Minnesotans for something, that we're always consistent in the way that those names are presented both in the software and our website and in everywhere else. And I think that kind of goes back to the name standardization, some of the other issues that we're looking at.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're correct, and Senator Kiffmeyer is correct, that in the software you're not able to search for find a donor that contains this phrase, which would be some benefit. We're constantly now looking at the trade-off between major versus minor enhancements to the client-based software, the one that we send out that resides on your own computer, versus efforts to develop the online-based software, which will be our next true generation. Our in-house staff has been working on the next online version for the last several months, and the first rollout of that will be more aimed at people who have internet access but don't have enough committee data to learn to merit learning the campaign finance software. So it will be more of a fill-in-the-form type software, but the forms and schedules will look a lot like they will ultimately in the online version. But the first version, which we're calling CFR Lite for short, will not have the capability of accumulating transactions for a treasurer. So it's for these small committees that already do everything on paper but want to have a way that they can file by going to the internet instead of writing it out on a piece of paper and sending it to us. But I think that this ability to search, to have an extra button that says find something that contains some string, would be beneficial. And I think that's something we would certainly look at incorporating into the online version of the software. There are two problems. There are lots of problems with the current version of the client-based software. It was built in 1998 at a cost of $85,000. I was project manager and helped develop specifications. A contractor actually did the work. It was built when your computer screens were small, and 480 by 640 was the resolution. So at that time, the form filled up the computer screen. As screens have got better, the form that you see has gotten smaller because it's a fixed resolution, and we've looked at whether we can make it bigger, and we're still looking at that. But the technology is dated. Everything about it is dated, and we're reluctant to add big enhancements to it. We are continuing to maintain it to accommodate legislative changes, but I think that a better search capability for donors will probably have to wait till the online version. Now, we had hoped to roll out CFR Lite in time for testing with some committees for this reporting period, but my IT staff has had some other things come up that took them away from that. So we will be testing the Lite version with a group of test committees, that people that volunteer to help us with things like this during the year. And certainly that will be rolled out before the next reporting period. But I would not anticipate that a full-blown web-based reporting system would be available. Won't be available this calendar year. I'm hoping that it will be available for the next election cycle.
And although this is not a funding division, will you need to request additional funding for that to occur? Can you use the existing appropriation?
That's a good question, Madam Chair, and it gets to Senator Hoffman's question as well. And here's my concern. For the campaign finance reporter, I don't have a big concern because the knowledge and expertise is so unique to that application. You need somebody that knows campaign finance law, knows the requirements, as well as knows how to design software. And we have that person in our office now, and he is the person who supports campaign finance type things. We have another IT staff who supports our staff and users of the software. If you've had a question on the software, he'll be the support person for you. I think we can handle that piece with those existing resources. My concern is that the $130,000 to $150,000 per year money that was available for the other projects, and even if we eliminate electronic records management, put that into the future sometime at an undisclosed time or an unknown time, and just limit it to data and web. I will, because of the late start, it looks like we may have some money that we are unable to prudently spend before the end of this fiscal year. Not a lot, but maybe $50,000 or maybe even more. I'm also, this also makes me reluctant to fill that 0.6 position, because if we do, then I will be limited to $75,000 for development beginning on July 1, and I need more than that. So that is a potential issue. I will have better figures as we, as the weeks progress, but I am a little bit concerned. State salaries, as I predicted, and I guess everybody would know, have gone up at the rate of about 3% a year plus some step increases. So that's eating into that cushion that we had built into our budget.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to interrupt for a second. Mr. Goldsmith does his very best to stretch every dollar, and that's certainly admirable. But we've had monthly reports to the board on the progress in the website project, and it's just my feeling that if we're going to be sure that this is done for the fall election, that we're going to need some additional outside help, and I think that would be a positive mood.
Well, Mr. Beck, to that point, there was a very robust conversation following the Star Tribune report, and I think it's incumbent on us as a committee to do our due diligence to ensure that there is some transparency for the public, so that especially as campaigns are becoming more increasingly expensive, that there is some expectation that the public could go and search the campaign finance database relatively easily to determine how much money is being spent on Minnesota elections. So that's something that we certainly hold as a high priority for this committee.
Madam Chair, the board certainly agrees with that. And we are very supportive of making sure that everything that we have is available easily. We have a lot of data, but if people can't access it and understand it, it doesn't do much good.
Right. And recognizing, I certainly recognize that with the exception of the additional increase in the last biennium, the board has been under a very tight funding situation prior to that. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you just, Your Honor, Mr. Beck, you put in to play that somehow, yeah, you are really good, Mr. Goldsmith, you know where every dollar is spent, and thank you for reminding us that, and you get bang for the buck. But I'm still concerned, if there's a way that we can be proactive in this, because what Senator Kiffmeyer brings up, what you bring up, what we bring up as a group is, are we tracking those changes, prudently? Are we tracking those changes proactively? So in case there's an, oh, no, I need $50,000 to finish this, I'd rather see this being spent well, so that, you, like you say, Madam Chair, you should be able to search that database. So somehow, can we get updates from, the board itself, whether it be through emails, through the chair, just so we're all on the same page regarding what they need in order to get what we expect that to be done.
Mr. Goldsmith, will you keep us apprised as the committee on the progress that you began in January and then the longer-term project as well?
Certainly, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Who would like to address the committee next?
I think that's all I have for the moment.
Mr. Sigurdsson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the one other issue or a project, this is going a little out of order, I believe, from what Mr. Beck defined as my role here, but I did want to talk to you a little bit about online compliance training, which is part of our web development as well. Certainly navigation, so that the public can find the information that they're looking for, improving the quality of the data, improving our ability to support the data are all elements that Mr. Goldsmith talked about. But one other issue that's near and dear to my heart, because I do the compliance training in the classroom, is increasing our ability to support the volunteer treasurers, who often find the procedures and requirements of Chapter 10A to be rather daunting. What we now currently provide basically is in-class training here in the Capitol complex. Last year I did, I think, 16 compliance classes and did training for about 200 treasurers. And the year prior to that, Mr. Goldsmith went to Greater Minnesota and conducted, I believe, 6 or 7 training classes. So we do try to get out state, but it's limited. And especially during the election year, it becomes very difficult to have staff leave the office for prolonged periods of time. So one thing that we are doing, we've already issued the RFP and received 5 different vendor replies to that RFP, is to move our compliance training to the web. It will basically allow initially all the treasurers to get all the information that they want on how to process contributions, the compliance issues that come with contributions, the record keeping that's required for contributions, and how, again, to both enter those into the software and report them in other ways. That's the first step. We will have that done by the end of the fiscal year by definition of the RFP, but then we're also putting in place the ability to enhance that. And again, looking towards 2016, I think you'll be able to have your volunteer treasurer go online, get complete training if they're a new treasurer, or perhaps even more usefully if they're an experienced treasurer but who have some question on a particular element of recording and reporting contributions and expenditures, can go and find a quick online refresher for them so that they can avoid the type of compliance issues and reconciliation issues that we've been talking about. So we're very excited about that project as well. We're not exactly sure what that's going to run because we haven't opened the sealed bids, but we're looking at around $25,000, I believe, for that project as well. If it's all right with the chair, then I would also, I think, go to the reconciliation project, since that, again, is related to the website and perhaps would provide some more information on that. I did provide a copy of the memo to board members or to committee members, and I apologize for having the wrong date. Hopefully before the grass grows green, I'll learn that it's 2015. It's dated January 12, 2014, but it was, in fact, for this year. As background, and I know we have at least a couple of members to the committee who weren't here, the Star Tribune published in November 10th of 2014 an article where they identified in a copy of the database that they acquired from the board over $20 million in records or in contributions between registered committees, that is to say contributions given by a political party unit or a political committee or fund to a candidate or between themselves, as being only reported by one of the two entities. Perhaps it was reported as being given but not received, or it was reported as being received but not given. So they didn't
reconcile. Mr. Sigerson, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that article, I think, well, I'm pretty sure it was November 10th of 2013. Because
correct.
That was, then we had the hearing a month after that, roughly.
Correct. Yep. You're correct, Madam Chair. And then on December 10th, 2013 was your joint hearing. Basically, the Star Tribune had alerted staff to that issue, and we cooperated in confirming that they had, in fact, found problems with the reconciliation of the contributions in the database, which is of concern not only in terms of the obvious reason that we provided information or were maintaining information that wasn't reconciled, but also because that same database is used for the searchable features that you've been talking about in terms of the public's ability to look up contributions on the website. Immediately in response to that, contributions that did not reconcile were removed from the website so that only reconciled contributions are available for the searchable database. And then, as we've mentioned, on December 10th of 13, the Senate Rules and Administration Subcommittee on Elections and the House Committee on Elections held a joint hearing. And this memo basically is to serve as an update as where we've gone from there. The scope of the problem, just to again to confirm or make sure that we're all talking about the same thing, is only talking about contributions between registered entities. We're not talking about contributions between individuals because there is no reconciliation available there. They're obviously not reporting individually to the board. We found, and by we I mean the staff found, that actually the Star Tribune had underestimated the problem, that the problem wasn't $20 million, it was $20 million. It was actually $26 million. And if you then flip the memo over to the table that's on the second page, you can kind of see where we've gone. The far left-hand column of November 2013 is for the years 2000 through 2012. And at that point, which is basically when we became initially aware of the problem, the amount of contributions that did not reconcile was $26,265,000. Roughly 6 months later, in April of 14, that number had been reduced to $13 million, a little over $13 million. And then most recently, we're now down to about $12 million, and that's including the fact that we've actually added a full year of reconciliation, and that's being 2013, which occurred after the Star Tribune story. The focus of the board initially, or excuse me, the focus of staff initially was to look at very large contributions that didn't reconcile. And we were able to reduce, for example, 2002 from over $6 million in records that don't reconcile to currently $1.8 million that don't reconcile. But it became obvious to the board that they would prefer to concentrate only in the most recent years, at least for the time being. And that's what we've done, 2009 through 2012. And, of course, 2013, which, again, occurred after the story, as when our staff has been spending most of the effort. And if you look at that, those 5 years are now well into the 90 percentile, some 99.89 for 2013. So the steps that staff has put into place in terms of verifying manual data entry of contributions, of being able to capture the expenditure reports and then compare that and look for in that data for contributions that may have been misclassified, and then also just to work better with committees in resolving reconciliation issues, I think has been effective in getting us up into the, again, high 90 percentiles for the most recent years. And as I mentioned earlier, it looks like 2014, again, with incomplete data, is already at reconciled over 90%, which is, we believe, a high for a for a reporting year where we haven't even received the year-end reports. I would want to, I think, also mention to the members of the committee that the reconciliation that you see, with the exception of 2013, which was basically through correspondence with treasurers, was primarily done with existing board records, which is to say that the information was, in fact, already in our office. There had been amendments who had been filed, the amendments that had been filed in response to the reconciliation letters that are sent out every year. But in some cases, staff simply had not put that information into the database, causing a problem. There were cases where information was changed basically by staff. It was fairly obvious what the problem was. A change letter was sent to the treasurer saying, "We've changed this for you. In the future, please don't do it again." And then they would file the next report electronically and promptly overwrite the change that staff had made because we hadn't made them change it in their copy of the database. So we've eliminated those sort of procedural errors that were causing reconciliation problems. We were able to track down quite a few records or quite a few reconciliation problems and resolve them basically by pulling out a report and just spending staff time looking at the report and seeing what's going on. Through that, we're now down to about $14 million out of the original 26 that didn't reconcile. So we've eliminated about 54% of the problem. And as Mr. Goldsmith mentioned, staff will soon be coming up with some questions, some recommendations, but some questions for the board as to just how appropriate it will be to look at, for example, year 2000 at this point, or if we should concentrate on, again, the more recent years, or where our next steps are.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdson. Questions? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So in regards to what's left here, which it appears to be not reconciled as the $12 million, is it the intention of the board to reconcile 100% of the rest of this $12 million sum?
Mr. Beck, can you answer that?
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, that's going to be a topic at the upcoming board meeting. It seems as though putting in the effort to come to 99% back to the year 2000 may not be very significant, may not actually allow us to have that much more information. So we're going to talk about that, and of course we'd be interested in your input.
Well, Madam Chair, I think for me, you're the ones that know the level of effort that it takes to accomplish that. I would not have, nor would any of us on the committee, I think, have the knowledge or the wherewithal to have gone through this, to have an assessment of that. I think that's something that maybe as a policy we decide. But beyond that, I do have a question. What do you mean? Can you define what total transfers reported, what that column means? I don't see that word transfers other than those last two columns. I'm not quite sure what that defines.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, the total transfers reported is the total number of contributions reported as being given by a registered committee to another registered committee. So during those years, a total of $141 million, somewhat more than that, was reported as being given from a registered committee or party unit to either a candidate or to another registered party unit. So basically there we can do the reconciliation, because since they're both reporting, we should be able to match them up in both reports when the contribution is made. The percentage of that then is how much we have currently reconciled. So if you look at 2009, currently we have 96.7% of all the records reported as a transfer during that year reconciled, so that they now match up.
So, Madam Chair, so the transfers mean only contributions, not what was received? Because when you reconcile, you have what's given and what's received. So what I'm seeing this number of $141 million, this is a total number both reported as given and reported as received. So you might say the same contribution would be double counted in a way.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, that's correct. We are looking at the table. There's basically separate tables, contributions that a registered committee report is given to another registered committee, and then all of the registered committees have a donor table, which is, okay, these are the contributions that we received. So that's the amount that we're looking for that year to reconcile. Again, I guess looking at an example, 2010, $25,459,000. That's the amount reported as being given directly to candidates or maybe to another party unit, and we're making sure that those numbers then match up. It does not include contributions from individuals. That was the, on the front, you can see the overall number of amount of money that we're looking at is, in terms of itemized contributions, is over $406 million. But the amount that occurs between registered committees is $141 million.
Okay.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, and I think one of the other questions I have for you is that you mentioned that you had started with the largest contributions, which makes total sense. That I remember reading there was some huge amount that got reconciled rather promptly, and that was kind of nice to drop you down right away on a big thing. But where are you at? Are you down to the 500 level or the 400 level? Kind of how? What kind of progress have you made of working your way down to? Because it looks like you only are going down to the over 100. So where are you in that scale right now? How close are you to that 100?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, anything that's shown as being not reconciled at this point is over $100. So, for example, if there was a contribution reported by both sides that was $50 off, frankly, we're not including that. We're not going to spend the staff time to track down the $50. But if it's over $100, a $200 difference, then we will. In terms of the very large contributions, the only year which I believe that there may be some large contributions left is 2008. We simply didn't quite get to 2008 before we concentrated on the most recent years, and there may be a couple of large contributions there, but in general, large contributions have been dealt with.
Madam Chair, I'm looking for a definition. What is a large contribution? What is that range? I'm looking at 100 up to what amount? Okay. And where are you at? What's the dollar amount you're at now that you're working on?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, and in truth, I don't have an exact dollar point for you. In terms of what we look at for a large contribution, for example, there were a number of cases where a political fund affiliated with a labor union would report the transfer of membership dues or that percentage of membership dues into the political fund, which they're required to do. That's appropriate. But in the software, unfortunately, it was a little easy for them to say, well, I don't want to create an entity. I don't want to create X labor union dues. I'm just going to say what's on the drop-down menu. Oh, here's one. it's them. In other words, they reported as receiving the contribution from themselves. When we looked at those, there were a lot that were like $40,000, $50,000. And so those were the sort of large contributions that were easy to, you know, they were low-hanging fruit, and we were able to move through those fairly quickly to resolve them.
Mr. Goldsmith?
As I understand it, Mr. Sigurdsson is actually the expert on this, so I'm going to ask him if I understand it correctly. But I think that once we eliminated, we had a list, and once we eliminated the ones that stood out on the list, I think for these more recent years, we just start at the top and we do them all. We don't, we aren't starting at, you know, 500 and then 400 and 300. We're just going down the list.
Madam Chair, committee members, that's correct. For the ones in gray, 2009 through 2013, we made no distinction. We were trying to get to zero problems for those years. We were not just looking at large contributions. We were looking at all contributions for those years.
Okay. That gives me a better picture. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sandy, would you like to proceed now with your testimony about the changes that were made last year?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. Thank you. Thank you for having us here. We've endeavored since I joined the board a little over a year ago to have board members more actively involved so that you see us. But we go through what is a more rigorous confirmation process than any other appointment in the state, and we want you to continue to see us around as well as the staff. I spoke with our colleague on the board, former Senator Ed Oliver, this morning, and he sends his regards. He asked me particularly to say hi to Senator Limmer, his former colleague. So the board members, even if they're not here, are actively involved in what we're doing. I would just like to give you a quick summary of how we implemented the law you passed last year regarding the complaint and investigation process. It came about, it was in Chapter 309 of the 2014 session laws, and it to a certain extent changed our complaint process, but it also put in writing some of the things that we've already done. Parties have always had an opportunity to appear before the board during an investigation and when complaints are filed. Maybe they didn't ask. Maybe they didn't know. Now, because it's in the rules, it's very clear. The other thing we wanted to do was to put into specific rules how complaint processes occur. It doesn't come up that often, and we'd like, for example, a lawyer in Senator Kiffmeyer's district in Big Lake to be able to refer to a complaint process on paper in the internet as easily as a lawyer in downtown Minneapolis, so that it's clear that if someone ever is a recipient of a complaint or wants to file a complaint, they can look in the rules and see the roadmap. Following your enactment of the law, you instructed us to do an expedited rulemaking, which we did. You gave us a deadline of the end of the year to implement our new rules. We did that, and we received written comments to the rules. We held public hearings. We also received written comments from members of the legislature, including Chair Sieben, Senator Hoffman, Senator Scott Newman, and Representative Tim Sanders. So we got some great input, and we were able to clear up a couple things. The previous law required that the board investigate all complaints filed with the board. We had one rule that would allow us to weed out frivolous complaints, but it was an incredibly low standard. That now the process that we have is when we receive a complaint with the board, it goes to what is called a prima facie determination, and that goes to an individual board member. The chair makes a decision based on staff recommendation as to whether the complaint sets out a prima facie, alleges a prima facie violation of a statute over which we have jurisdiction. That's key. Sometimes we get complaints that allege a violation that we just don't have jurisdiction over, and in that case, we're able to remove it immediately. Parties have an opportunity to respond at the prima facie stage, and then within 30 days of a complaint being filed, the board member will either accept it or reject it. If it's rejected, the complainant can refile it, and if the complaint is refiled, it will go to a different board member who supports a different political party. Again, to preserve the nonpartisan nature of our investigations. After that, the matter is scheduled for probable cause hearing, and this is where it was key in the law that that you passed. That the and I should mention also, this is this was something that Senator Hoffman and Senator Scott Newman were actively involved in the conference committee, and were very instructive on how they wanted us to go ahead with law. It was very helpful to us as a board to have such active involvement from the legislature. At the probable cause stage, it's very clear that both the complainant and the respondent are given an opportunity to be heard if they choose by the board. That's before any investigation takes place. And at that point, then the board will rule as to whether there's probable cause to believe a violation has occurred. If we do issue such a ruling, then it would go to an investigation, and the board is involved in overseeing the investigation, setting out the scope of the investigation. We can also resolve the complaint. A lot of the complaints get resolved by conciliation agreement at that point. And one thing we've been more active in doing over the past year or so is using what we would call suspended penalties, or a way that, or I'll give you an example. If a lobbyist makes a contribution during a legislative session and doesn't include the lobbyist registration number on the check, you might, a candidate committee or a caucus a party unit may accept that contribution without being aware that it's from a lobbyist. In that case, if we do issue a penalty, we may do a lower penalty with the lobbyist on the understanding that they agree to pay a higher penalty if they violate again later. So it's a carrot and stick approach that I think we've found successful to us. It's never been our goal to ding someone hard for their first violation. And I think if you point out to them that, you know, we'll charge you this lower amount now, there's more later, you'll see registration numbers showing up on checks. As before I was appointed to the board, I served as a volunteer treasurer for several candidate committees. And Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm sympathetic to that. It's annoying as a candidate, particularly lobbyists with the last name Johnson. You know, what are you going to do? So it's been our goal on the board to encourage that through using suspended penalties. And I can just in summary, I can tell you what I like about the law, and what I think is next. I like the complaints are that our investigations are confidential. That there are matters that are heard in executive session. If you read about an investigation that is going on in front of the Campaign Finance Board, a pending investigation, you're not hearing about it from us. It's a press release that may be issued by a complainant or issued by a respondent, but in fact we are, as members of the board and staff members, compelled by statute not to acknowledge any facts or details in a pending investigation, and could be subject to a civil penalty of up to $1,000. I like that. I think it's helpful to take investigations out of the political arena. If parties are going to issue a press release, you know, it's their First Amendment right. But you'll see that the stories don't get much legs if the media is not allowed to contact board members, or board members are not allowed to respond to media inquiries or our executive director. And I think that stood very well over the test of time, and you preserve that in the last law. I like that parties now clearly know that they have an opportunity to be heard both at the probable cause stage and also, I forgot to mention, before the board issues any findings at the conclusion of an investigation, the respondent still has an opportunity to be heard. When I was first appointed to the board, I had a great visit with former U.S. Attorney Tom Heffelfinger, who used to be a member of the board. And the way he explained our investigation process to me was, he said that when a complaint is filed with the board and the board accepts the complaint, we're stepping into the shoes of the complainant and we're dedicating taxpayer resources to an investigation. And so it's important at that point for the board to be able to sit across the table from both the complainant and the respondent, if they choose, to come tell us what they think. And also for the board to be involved in overseeing staff. It's also important to note that the law, as it came about and as it has been implemented, it really did not occur because of any allegations of wrongdoing by staff or anything like that. So I think we're able to implement that in the light of day as we think about how we go ahead with this process without having to be concerned about, well, this happened in the past, we don't want that. I think that's great. Our next steps now are we have some minor changes that we're discussing that might allow us to speed up the complaint process between when a complaint is filed and when it comes to a probable cause hearing. And we need to talk about that with the board amongst ourselves, but we may have some options to bring to the legislature just at that stage to give parties, if they're the recipient of a complaint, to either get rid of the complaint quickly or get them in front of the board for a probable cause hearing soon so that they don't have the matter hanging over them. The other thing is our staff is now working on just kind of a user-friendly summary of the complaint process that I think I've explained inartfully to you so that people can go to our website to know how to file a complaint, how the process works, how to respond to a complaint. And I think probably the most important thing that I can point out to you at the end, I should have led with this, this rulemaking consumed a fair amount of staff time in the second half of last year, from June until December. One of our staff members, Jody Pope, worked on it almost exclusively, but it certainly involved an awful lot of effort from our director and our executive director. That process is complete, and so if we're behind the ball a little bit on the website, I think our time is freed up now, particularly from staff, to be more involved in improving our public disclosure abilities and tools so that we can do that. We weren't expecting to do a rulemaking when we spoke with you at the beginning of the session last year, and we did it, and it took a huge amount of work, but we're done with it. And so I hope that we won't need to be as focused on it in 2015 as we were in 2014.
Thank you for that. I thought it was an artful update, an artful presentation. Mr. Sandy, are there any questions for the committee? With that, I failed to do this at the beginning, but I'd like to welcome Senator Hall and Senator Carlson to the Subcommittee on Elections. We look forward to your service on the committee, and please don't hesitate to contact me if I can be of help in any way. I'd also like to congratulate Senator Kiffmeyer on now being the lead Republican on the committee. And with our long-standing understanding that this committee tries to pass bills in a bipartisan manner, I look forward to working as closely with you, Senator Kiffmeyer, as I did with your predecessor.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I do have a brief wrap-up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Let's just finish our introductions, and then we'll get back to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Beck, I apologize. Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, I wonder if we could also get an update on your little child. How old and how?
Which one?
The young one you had last year. Yeah.
So my kids are now seven, well, almost seven, three and one and a half. One and a half broke her leg on Thanksgiving Day on a slide. But she's doing great now. So
great.
Not that maybe, but everything's going fine. Thank you for asking. And Chris, if you could please stand up, Chris, and tell us a little bit about yourself. He is our committee page for this session.
I live in Minneapolis. I'm originally from Edina. I've been a page here for two sessions previously, and now I'm the lead page. All
right. Thank you. Yep. We look forward. We appreciate your service. Ms. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to – thanks for the update, because that was Senator Newman and I spent a long time, many times, out into the hallway of the chamber and talking about how does this keep transparency. And so we're looking forward to what the board's recommendations are regarding – you know, we knew it was a work in process, a new progress, I suppose, and what we can do to make sure that that's completed. And I know Senator Newman is expressed to me, and I think that he would still be very much available to have discussions regarding that as well. But you'll let us know about what's needed to make those fixes so that they stay with the desire that Senator Newman and the rest of us wanted with transparency.
Senator Kiffmeyer, if you could please introduce your new staff, too. I apologize. I Didn't meet you.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Ms. Amy Strange is our GOP staff person, researcher. So we're glad to have Amy working with us. But she's not new to the legislative process, so she'll bring some good experience and knowledge for us.
Welcome. And Mr. Beck, now finally back to you.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to assure the committee that the board has strongly supported the website development and the data reconciliation, and I'm sure they will support ending these projects before fall. The staff has worked hard on these projects. We know that from their monthly reports, and I'm sure they will continue to do so. You're probably aware, and I'm kind of proud of the fact that our board is a bipartisan six-member panel. We have no more than three members from each party. The members must be confirmed by both the Senate and the House, and I think we're the only board that has that distinction. And a vote of four members is necessary to decide any matter. Among the things that we're looking at is the disclosure legislation that this committee considered last session. This past fall, the board voted to support that again in this session. It was amended to exclude communications sent only to members, as was requested by the opponents last spring. The importance of disclosure has grown with the Citizens United case, which has allowed more money to flow into political campaigns. In Minnesota, the independent contributions now greatly exceed those made to candidates. However, even though the Citizens United Court permitted increased contributions, it also explicitly approved disclosure as a check on greater contributions. The situation in Minnesota now is behind a large number of other states in that issue ads, so-called issue ads, can be presented before an election, immediately before an election, and as long as they don't use explicit words like vote for, they do not have to be registered with the board, or do the contributions have to be reported. So those are undisclosed contributions. And I think the result of these loopholes is unreported spending by special interests attacking candidates' positions shortly before an election. The board thinks that voters should know who is financially supporting a candidate, and we should all know how much money is being spent in our elections. Just very briefly, other matters we expect to look at, we're going to take a hard look at the 2014 election contributions and expenditures, which will be submitted early next month. We hope to look at whether there's a need to better define what constitutes coordination or cooperation between candidates and independent expenditure committees so that those rules are clear. We expect to look at the adequacy of original source disclosure, that is, contributions made through an intermediary, which is sometimes called the Russian doll problem. This concludes our presentation, and thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Beck, Mr. Sandy, Mr. Goldsmith, and Mr. Sigurdsson. We appreciate all of your efforts. I particularly would like to thank the board for your advocacy for the campaign finance bill, which you discussed, and think that in light, I feel more strongly than ever in light of the most recent election, that it's so important that the public has the ability to see where campaign contributions and expenditures, who is behind those. And right now, unfortunately, because we weren't able to pass that bill, no matter what we do on reconciling differences between campaign committees, there's still this whole source of dark money that is not transparent to the general public. So I'm hopeful that we could do something on that this legislative session. With that, the committee is adjourned.